la religion. Ma propre parole.
Welcome to You, Me, Empathy. Thank you for listening. We would like to remind you that this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Known as just a silly boy with a feely heart. Please consider supporting the show. Check us out on Patreon or simply leave a review on iTunes. Here's your host and creator of the show, Known Wells.
Hello, feely humans. Welcome to You, Me, Empathy. Today is episode 64. I chat with my friend Callie Lux, who's head of marketing at Work It Health. We talk about opioid addiction, the stigmatization of addiction, and why feely humans in recovery are beacons of hope to us all. Callie's story is quite tremendous, and it needs to be heard, and she's a beautiful feely human, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Before we get to that, though, I just wanted to mention that today, this Monday, February 25th, is the start of National Eating Disorder Awareness Week. It's all this week, and if you check out my website, knownwells.com, knownwells.com, you'll see on the blog, a new piece of writing I did. I'm writing it today, actually, on this Sunday. Just some thoughts about my story with anorexia, and go check it out. Let me know what you think. And to all of those who are in recovery from anorexia or bulimia or any eating disorder or are currently struggling, my heart goes out to you. I know what it feels like to struggle with that. And just know that there is hope and that, you know, your body is yours. And, you know, no amount of what society tells us what our body should be, you know, has any control over us, right? I know it's hard to sometimes accept that. And sometimes face that reality because these social norms and societal cues are so strong, especially for women. Men have it much easier. I certainly have it much easier. I'll keep this personal. I have it much easier than a woman, for instance. But the point is that you are loved and you are valued by me. And if you ever need to talk about your struggle with your eating disorder, I'm happy to listen and to talk because I've been there and I know that struggle. So please reach out if you'd like. You can DM me on Instagram at YouMeEmpathy or you can email me YouMeEmpathy@gmail.com. Okay. Thanks for that, listening to that. And please go follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at YouMeEmpathy. We have a Facebook group. It's at facebook.com/groups/YouMeEmpathy. I have a Patreon page where you can support the show on an ongoing basis. That's at patreon.com/YouMeEmpathy. Also, look out for, I recently posted about this on Instagram. I am doing some, I'm collaborating with my friend Bryn Woodley on some feely human items. Feely human is a thing that I like to call you guys. It is certainly who I am. And we are going to be doing some pins. I have a vision for feely human pins, feely human t-shirts, bumper stickers, magnets, maybe even some prints that you can sell and put up on the walls in your apartment or house, what have you. I don't know. I just think to use Bryn's sort of terminology, I want to create a feely human collective, a feely human force for good. Let's create a community of feely humans. I know you guys are out there. So thanks for that. Check that out and look out for more announcements about that excitement coming soon. And without further ado, enjoy episode 64 of You, Me, Empathy with Callie Lux on opioid addiction, the stigmatization of addiction, and why feely humans in recovery are beacons of hope to us all.
Hey la la. You, 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 you. Me. Empathy.
Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, a podcast about exploring the struggles we face in our day-to-day lives as humans trying to get by on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. The intent of You, Me, Empathy is to talk openly, without judgment, about our neuroses, our mental illnesses, our shared anxieties and worries, to create a dialogue that is vulnerable and deeply human and empathetic, and to share that dialogue with others to inspire emotional and cognitive collaboration and insight, so we can, hand in hand, break down the stigma that make us feel shame and guilt for struggling, for feeling our feelings, for being human. You, Me, Empathy is a safe, friendly space designed to inspire the beauty in each of us. Today, I'm so grateful for another empathy adventure with fellow bibliophile, addiction long-term recoverer, and Work It Health's head of marketing, Kelly Lux. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Noan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being on You, Me, Empathy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm excited that you're here. So
wonderful.
For the listeners, today we are going to explore a lot of things. Callie, as I mentioned, works for Work It Health. As you remember, a previous guest of the show, Robin, also works at Work It Health. So we're going to explore Callie's mental health journey, talk about addiction, and probably a bunch of other things. So we'll get to that. But before we do, we always have an emotional check-in at the top of the show. How are you feeling today? How's your week been, Callie?
You know, my week has been great. I went on vacation last week to Los Angeles, and it was wonderful. It was so nice to decompress and relax. I really turned off social media. I turned off my phone and didn't check on work at all and went to the beach. And so this week has also been really nice because I feel like I've just been still soaking up the relaxation from vacation. How has your week been?
Oh, hold on. I have follow-ups.
Oh, okay.
That's lovely. That's so good to hear that you got to, it's not often sometimes we struggle as humans to make the time to really be in the moment and relax. And so good on you for making that happen.
Yes, absolutely. I'm definitely someone who struggles with that. I am always constantly working and constantly checking my phone. So it was a small triumph for me to unplug and relax.
Awesome. Well, I'm happy for you. And you were not far from me because I'm just south of LA.
I know. I saw that. So I didn't realize. But yes, we could have done this in person last week I thought about it.
Next time.
Yes.
As for me, thanks for asking. As for me, it's been... So this morning, as of this morning, I was working on the yard. The listeners know that my wife and I moved into a new house, which is great. We bought a house, which is very exciting and overwhelming. So I've been working on the yard. And as I was working this morning, I realized we have this big, kind of beautiful plant out in the front of our front door. And it's an angel's trumpet, which turns out is very poisonous.
So
my anxiety, nervous brain started looking up like, oh, what are the symptoms of angel's trumpet poisoning? And of course, like my brain goes to like, oh no, my mouth has been drier. And, you know, so I called poison control and just kind of expressed my anxieties to them. And they were kind enough to say, it is very poisonous, but as long as you don't ingest it, you'll be fine. But they did recommend removing it. So I'm going to be doing that after this. But I don't know. I wonder if you can relate to that, Callie, where maybe you have a different anxiety brain. Maybe you don't have an anxiety brain at all, but like that's where my anxiety brain went.
Oh, no, I absolutely have an anxiety brain that is so susceptible to the power of suggestion. Yeah. I think if someone around me mentions that they get sick for some reason, I'll be like, oh, my gosh, I think I get that sickness for that same reason. And then I'll be like, oh, my gosh, I'm kind of feeling like that now. So, yeah, that's something I can definitely relate to because I am very I'm very in my head and very in tune with my body, and I have been for my whole life, which I don't, I think it's a gift and a curse, you know, because I can really connect with people and I can really connect with myself. I can really know what's going on for me internally, but at the same time, I can take that a little too far.
Yeah, I relate to that very strongly. I do think it's a gift and a curse. I think that's well put. Because, yeah, we do, you know, oftentimes like that sort of framework or that strong feelings comes from a person who has, you know, deep empathy and deep feeling. And of course, you know, I've certainly gone to a place where I've taken that too far and forgotten about my own sort of self-care or, you know, not listening to my body, but sort of trying to help others to a point where it's, you know, it's almost a little masochistic.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't ingest the plant. It's a beautiful plant. You know, it's kind of like a tree almost, but it's like a long, you know, it is technically a plant. But I'm going to remove it, and that will be peace of mind.
Yes, it'll be gone and out of sight, out of mind, and out of risk of even getting poisoned by it.
Indeed. Apparently it's a plant that is grown commonly in South America and used by companies to make medicine.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I wonder how it got in your yard. Someone planted it for decoration there?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, our yard is, so we live in an area where there's beautiful oak trees. We have like three, like 100-plus-year-old oak trees in our yard, which is my favorite tree. I love oak trees, great climbing trees. But it's also a melange of just why. Like, I'm still trying to figure out like what all these trees are and plants are. There's just the previous owners liked a variety, so it's gonna be an adventure trying to figure out all, you know, what's all out there.
Right. Yeah.
Well, Callie, let's transition into kind of where your mental health origin started. Can you give me maybe a few seminal moments in your mental health journey that maybe speak to who you are today, or just seminal moments that stick out to you from childhood, adolescence, yeah, et cetera?
Absolutely. Yep. So I love talking about mental health because I think that growing up, I didn't understand what it was, or I didn't understand that the feelings I was experiencing were normal, and it was such a huge problem for me. So as a small child, I had really bad motion sickness. So I would be a little kid who was on the bus, wouldn't talk to anyone, and would suddenly throw up. And it was so embarrassing for me and so shameful for me that I had this physical illness that I couldn't control, that it kind of bubbled up and bubbled over into extreme anxiety to the point that I would get really bad panic attacks because I wouldn't want to get sick on car trips. I wouldn't want to get sick on the bus. I wouldn't want to get sick anywhere. So I would just sit and be internally having horrible, horrible panic attacks, but I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to explain that as a small child. I didn't know even that anything was wrong necessarily or how to voice it.
Wow.
So that was really like my first mental health experience, was just that sort of this physical issue that I had. I had a lot of shame around it, and I had a lot of fear around it too, because I was embarrassed. I didn't want to get sick around people, and it sort of stemmed into this huge panic problem for me. And so after that, growing up, I kind of grew out of motion sickness, thank goodness, once I got into adolescence. But I grew up and began struggling a little bit more with depression and things like that. But again, didn't really know what to name it or call it. And then after that, I eventually started dabbling in drug use and eventually started doing drugs every day and drinking every day and eventually became addicted to drugs and alcohol. So that was more of a later in life. But sure. I think a pivotal moment for me in middle school relating to depression was that we were talking about depression in a health class. And it made me so uncomfortable that I was trying to like draw flowers around the symptoms of being depressed because I realized that I had some of these symptoms. Like I knew even at that age that I thought about killing myself. I just knew things weren't right for me. And I was so uncomfortable even realizing that. Because I knew that that was incredibly wrong, right? You weren't supposed to feel depressed in that way. And I just had such shame around it that I couldn't even just leave the words on the page in my notes that I was taking in my class. I had to kind of draw happy images around them and make them look more acceptable. And that's definitely something I remember from very early on, just not really being able to synthesize that having mental health issues was okay. You know, that you could struggle with mental health things. You could feel these scary feelings and you could grow through them and process through them and be okay. So I had a lot of fear around my mental health stuff when I was young and I didn't really understand fully what it was.
Yeah, understandably. I mean, having this motion sickness reaction, that physical reaction, it's, to use a blunt word, it's shocking, right? And right. To the people around you, it may be shocking or gross or whatever, and not having the words, the tools, the knowledge, whatever you want to call it, the emotional intelligence to like process that. I mean, of course, like at a young age, like we don't have that, but it's what strikes me about that image and that experience is the commonality of people of our age range having these experiences where we feel a thing and we feel maybe like we're identifying with this thing called depression or this thing called shame or this thing called anxiety, and we can't talk about it. And we don't know how to talk about it. And my heart goes out to you going through that, because I know that little girl, and I because I was that little boy, right. Like and so many of us were, and I my hope is we get there as a society where we can, where kids grew up in an environment where they're like, oh yeah, this is a thing, this is something, this is the this is language I know, and I could talk about it openly. It's, do you see? Well, let me back up. Did you ever talk about that early goings on, like feelings of depression, with friends, with family members, or you just kept it all in?
I really kept it all in. My parents were great. I wasn't like one of those people who I was very privileged, as a child. And I think my parents could sense that there was something wrong, and they definitely tried to help me with breathing techniques and stuff like that. But I remember seeing a book at Barnes & Noble at some point, maybe in middle school, that talked about symptoms of anxiety. And I just walked past the book. I think it was on the sale rack, like the $5 bargain bin. And it like had a cover that was like, do you feel anxious? Can you not go to sleep? And all of these things. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is me, and I read all those symptoms off. And I was like, I think this is what's happening to me, So
what did that feel like?
It it felt very validating from a point, but it also kind of blew my mind.
Yeah.
You know, because I thought that in many ways that this was just how I was and that that was how life was going to be. And I didn't realize that it was more like, oh, some people have a broken leg and I might have this issue in my head, you know, that I just haven't really learned about or learned how to process.
And, you know, your parents recognizing that you were struggling a bit, you know, offering you breathing exercises and things. Did you, were you voicing things with them? Did they voice things to you? Were they asking questions?
I don't think we were voicing things to each other as much as we should have been. And I think that's just because of the culture we lived in, you know. I think that we kind of were like, oh, everything is okay, you know, everything is good, and kind of encouraging each other to calm each other's anxieties by encouraging that everything was okay from a very young age, which I know a lot of people my age that grew up in homes like that, where we kind of put on a happy face and say everything's fine. And that's just how we grew up.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I were you raised in a religious home at all?
No, I was not. It's both my parents are very educated, and so they were really not religious at all.
Gotcha. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you're right. I think it's just broadly a cultural thing, sadly, as well, because I had the same experience. Obviously, I had the religious aspect of it, too, that made it, a little different, I guess. But so, Kelly, what, you know, when you started identifying yourself as maybe having symptoms of depression, how long did it take you to talk about it? Let's talk about it, but more just think about it. Because as you said, you know, when you first started identifying, maybe you didn't want to accept it.
Right. And I put it off. I think that's where the drinking and drug use comes into my story, because my parents had kind of warned me against drinking. Alcoholism runs in our family. There is a genetic factor there. And I knew that I wasn't ever feeling quite normal. I was already very anxious. So I kind of tried to stay away from drugs and alcohol. But in my teens, I tried drugs, and before I drank even, and they just made me feel better than normal, right? I was kind of like, oh, this is how people are supposed to feel, you know? And so for a very long time, drugs and alcohol were my solution. And they were a solution for me to all sorts of problems, you know, mental health issues, you know, anything that was going wrong. I would just kind of mask things with drugs and alcohol. And so it wasn't really until I realized that drugs and alcohol weren't working for me anymore that I needed to deal with everything. I needed to deal with the anxiety I was feeling. I needed to deal with my depression. There were times when I was drinking and using that I tried to kill myself. I ended up hospitalized, and it wasn't until I took out the other factors like drugs and alcohol that I was able to really handle anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we're impaired by these things. Especially a combination of the two. Do you mind talking about what drugs you were taking?
Oh yeah, no, of course not. That's why I'm here. So I was sort of an all over dabbler when I was younger. I would just kind of do whatever people gave me. I mean, I was a teenager in the suburbs. I was really into the rave scene. It was like the 2000s. So
sure, I remember that.
Yep. It was a very big, I had short, spiky pink hair.
Oh,
so.
Of course you did.
Yes,
that's
yes.
That's perfect.
So,
I can picture you now.
Absolutely. So did a lot of ecstasy, coke, drank a lot of alcohol, and then eventually I got into, because I had anxiety, I found out that benzos like Xanax, Klonopin worked really well for me. You know, they were something I could take all the time and kind of evened me out, but I didn't take them as prescribed, right? I know those are medications that work for some people, and I really applaud, you know, everyone who seeks help and takes medication as they need it. But for me, I just would misuse them.
Right. What was it like going, how do I put this? What was it like finding that these things, these drugs, this alcohol was really not addressing the anxiety, the depression? Like what was that separation, that like, because I'd imagine you're creating this world where you feel good. You know,
right.
You feel better than you did before. You're perhaps creating a, you know, like maybe you have friends who are also doing it with you or people around you. You're establishing that an identity of sorts. Like what was like moving away from that like?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite books by Gabor Mate in the realm of Hungry Ghosts, he says that finding drugs and alcohol is like you're thirsty your entire life and you don't realize it. And it's like finding water for the first time. And that's really how it was for me. Trying drugs and alcohol for the first time, it was like it quenched a thirst I didn't know I had. Mm. And how things stopped working for me was a much slower process because I really clung to drugs and alcohol as a solution. And I think that's really common in addiction is we know that drugs and alcohol at one point made us feel good. And when they stop working and we have all these disastrous consequences, we're like, but this makes me feel good. Why can't I keep doing this?
Yeah.
So from a very young age, things kind of stopped working for me. My apartment was raided by the police when I was young. I was living with a drug dealer and I had a really bad falling out with my parents. And I mean, immediately that stuff just sent my anxiety through the roof. You know, it wasn't like I was very confident about losing my home and, you know, arguing with my parents all the time. It was like all of this wreckage that I was causing was making me incredibly anxious, but I was still clinging to drugs and alcohol because at one point they had worked for me. And then
that's what you knew.
Yeah, exactly. And then it got to a point where I really just wanted to sleep. You know, I was doing a lot of coke, I was drinking a lot, and I would get so sick from doing too many things. But then eventually, even after stopping everything, I went to treatment. I realized that I needed to stop. I sort of drifted back towards it with opioids because I was like, oh, I can just take one pill. You know, one mm-hmm. pill will be fine. It's not drinking, which I know is dangerous for me. And then I became addicted to opioids and they brought me back to the exact same place that I had been with other drugs. So I think that our brains, when we have found a solution like that at one point, even if it only worked for a very short time, no matter how much harm it causes us, it's really hard to see when we're in the midst of drinking and using. And for me, it really took, it's usually always the physical sickness or physical withdrawal. It was just being tired, not being able to stop, you know, not being very mood altered by the substances I was using, but not being able to give them up.
Yeah.
I would throw drugs down the garbage disposal and then try and reach them out of there. I would pour alcohol out and go buy more. It's really an obsession.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of realizing that I couldn't handle that obsession anymore and just becoming so exhausted with it that I would reach out to people for help.
It does. I mean, it sounds brutal. It sounds so cyclical and brutal just over and over again. I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sorry I had to go through it, too. I definitely have a lot of regrets. Like, I wasted, there are years I can't remember, and they're some of, like, what are supposed to be the best years of your life. I had a lot of opportunities that I didn't take advantage of because I was drinking and using. But also now I'm able to help other people. I'm able to, you know, talk about this, which is, I think, such a gift, especially as we're, you know, as so many people are struggling with opioid addiction. It's really powerful to be able to speak up and explain to other people that, no, I've been through this and I'm on the other side. You know, I have 9 years in recovery today and my life is amazing. And if you would have told me 9 years ago that I would be able to hold down a job, I wouldn't have chronic, you know, constant anxiety. I wouldn't believe you. I didn't think I would live to see 27 years old, and now I'm 34, 35. I don't even remember my age, but, yeah, it's quite a miraculous recovery, you know? So I'm really happy that I made it through everything, even if I have, even if I did have to struggle a lot.
Yeah, you're a beacon of hope for people who are also struggling. They can look at you and say, look, right. I can do this too.
Exactly. As all people in recovery are. I mean, that's really our power as people who have gotten through the other side of addiction is it's when you're in this dark hole of addiction, it is so hard to imagine another way of life. Because as you said, it's kind of like your friends are doing this. You know, it's your whole world. And so it is so powerful to see people who have gotten out of it and who have made it to the other side.
Yeah, I mean, just on a like a basic human level, we struggle with change, period, right?
Right, yep.
You know, we struggle with self-acceptance. We struggle with self-identity. And then if you add on top of that, a world where you're immersed in drugs and alcohol, and the pull and power of that, breaking away and changing and changing your identity and completely flipping that on its head, like, is even more challenging.
Right. Absolutely. You know? Yeah. It took me a really long time to realize who I was without drugs and alcohol. When I was drinking and using, I was definitely the party girl. You know, I was the life of the party. I would go out all every night. And now that I'm in recovery, I love to stay at home and read. And it's sort of wild to imagine that I used to think I was, you know, such a different person. But now I've really, you know, had time to learn who I am and listen to myself and listen to what my body's telling me, listen to what I need self-care wise, and kind of learn what my own interests are and really get to know myself. And that's something you don't do when you're drinking and using, because all you know is you're craving drugs and alcohol, you use drugs and alcohol. So it's really kind of an amazing time of growth once you do decide to quit.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit about you had mentioned that you sort of cut ties with your parents a little bit. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was young. I know people who started drinking and using very young, like when they were 13, but I think I tried drugs for the first time when I was maybe 14 or 15. And when I was 17, I moved out of my house and I lied about who I was living with. I said I was living with a friend and I was living with my boyfriend who was dealing drugs. And I put my parents through a lot, and eventually my boyfriend and my apartment got raided because he was dealing drugs and we got evicted. And my parents really wanted me to come live with them. They lived in a different state. And I flew back to, they had tried to get me to come and stay with them, sort of do an intervention, and I just picked up and left and kind of moved back in with this guy who was now on the run from the police. I lived in hotels with him, and I just completely stopped talking to my parents or let them know where I was. So, I mean, it was heartbreaking for them, I'm sure, and it was heartbreaking for me. But I was really in the midst of my disease, and I didn't kind of think about the wreckage I was causing at the time. But now we have a great relationship. We've mended it entirely. But it was a crazy time, you know, and I think that is one of the things, because you break the hearts of everyone around you because they see you just hurting yourself so badly, but you don't stop. And so they kind of pit themselves against you because they're asking you to stop doing this one thing that you can't stop doing. Today, everything is very good with us, but it was a really difficult time.
Yeah, I'd imagine it was. And it's such a hard thing to know that people in our lives, the people we love most, struggle and having no control over it. You know, I'd imagine your parents felt, at a loss and powerless,
right,
watching their daughter, you know, go through this over and over again.
Right. The great thing about my parents, I know a lot of parents who did like a very tough love approach in that they were totally hands off and just didn't give any help to anyone. And the great thing about my parents was they never gave up. And anytime I needed treatment, anytime I did reach out and call them, they were always there for me. They sort of always took me back,
even though
I like ran away from them, you know, and didn't talk to them. So there were a lot of opportunities when I reached out for help for them to say, no, we're not going to help you anymore because this is your third time in the hospital or this is your third time getting sober or something. But they never said that. And I know a lot of people in recovery who have not had that experience. I know people who have just been turned out when they were 18 and, you know, their parents haven't ever talked to them again. So for me, I mean, I couldn't, when I was addicted to opioids, I could not quit on my own and I had to go to detox. And the first person I called when I was ready to detox was my mom, even though I was so, you know, disappointed to tell her because she at that time assumed that I was in recovery. She didn't know I had relapsed on these opioids. Even though it was so disappointing for me to have to call this person who loved me and tell her that I needed help again, she helped me get into a detox and, you know, things like that, that family support is, it can really save someone's life because I don't know what I would have done if, you know, she hadn't been there for me. So
I'm so glad she was.
Yeah, absolutely.
What would you say to parents who have a son or daughter who, you know, adolescents, late teens, who is going through struggles and they feel, maybe the parents feel exhausted by it, tired by it, wanting to cut ties, wanting to give up? What would you say to those parents?
This is something that I do think about a lot because I talk to parents sometimes at work at Health who have adolescents who are going through this. So I think self-care for yourself is vital. You know, it's kind of like putting on the oxygen mask for yourself first and then for whoever you're with. Take care of yourself first. But addiction is a medical disease. You know, it's a chronic brain disease. It's not something people are doing at you. It's not something people are doing because they're angry at you or they don't love you and they're not trying to hurt you, even as much as you feel hurt. I personally, there are a lot of different belief systems out there, but I believe that you should never, ever give up on someone. If they're coming to you for help or if they're asking, you know, for a place to stay, if they're looking to get into treatment, if they're, you know, asking you for any sort of interaction, I just think that as long as you are able to take care of yourself and also help them in whatever way they're asking for, then I think that that's really important to do as someone who has been there and had my parents help me get out to the other side. If someone's threatening you, if you have a teenager who's stealing your stuff and physically threatening you, I think that's a really different situation. I think your safety needs to be priority number one. But as for, you know, tough love, kicking people out and not talking to them until they shape up, it's not about that. The consequences can get really, really bad. I've seen people have really extreme consequences and not stop. And it's not really going to make a difference.
Yeah. Do you, I think you said a really important thing, and it's this idea that it's not about you. I think right. That can be applied for really a lot of things. I think we as humans, we naturally want to take things personally, right? You know, like, oh, this thing that they're doing, like, how can they not see? Or how can they not see that it's affecting me in this way? But I think as we sort of mature and or just allow ourselves to, like, let go of that personal identification with this struggle of someone else, the, you know, we can better, you know, as you point out, self-care, et cetera, and better understand and get outside of ourselves a little bit. Cause we tend to do that. We want to make it about us, but it's not about us.
Right. Exactly. Cause we're seeing the world through the lens of our own eyes. So it's hard to not interpret everything as being about us, but it can be really empowering to realize that we're not that important and everything isn't about us.
I think that's one of the acceptances that we need to make as humans if we do want to grow and learn and be empathetic people.
Right.
So you also said a thing about how addiction is this medical disease. What do you say to people who maybe think otherwise?
Yeah, this is, this is a show about stigma, so this is a great thing to talk about as well, is addiction is still really stigmatized in America, and medical treatments for addiction are also really stigmatized for addiction. And the way that alcohol and drugs work is they change your brain chemistry, and they rewire your brain chemistry to actually cause you to crave drugs and alcohol. And the research shows this, and we can see this, and it's a diagnosable disease. And so it's just like any other disease in that if you had diabetes, you wouldn't ask someone with diabetes, like, why can't you just stop? You know, it's just not the way we think about another issue. But with addiction, we have this lack of understanding. We expect people to be able to just change their behavior in a way that we don't have the expectation for other issues. And so I think it really helps to understand that once you have begun using substances in this way, the brain is actually rewired and you are going to crave and get rewards, you know, by using drugs and alcohol. And it's just a vicious loop that you fall into. And it is a medical issue, and it needs to be treated just like we would treat anyone else with a medical issue, from cancer to a broken leg to, you know, diabetes or anxiety or depression. We need to really take a lot of the moral failing out of it.
Is it just a lack of education that sort of contributes to that narrow view of addiction, or are there other cultural things going on contributing to the stigma?
Oh, this gets into a really complicated conversation, but drugs are illegal. So a lot of drugs are illegal. So automatically, if you are struggling with addiction, you are a criminal in a lot of places. And so that stigmatizes drug use as well. So it's
like a moral thing.
Exactly. So there's a lack of education, but it's also just kind of an automatic stigmatizing by the law that when you have this physical issue, when you have this medical issue, you are breaking the law. So that's just another factor in it.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about the laws around alcohol, drugs, et cetera?
I think it's really complicated. I don't know if I am someone who could speak on it very well, but I do think that, you know, alcohol is legal and certain drugs are illegal. And I think that it doesn't really change people's level of addiction, whether or not they have access to the legal or illegal drugs. But what it does change is the safety of the substances they're consuming. Yeah. So right now, because heroin is illegal, we have a lot of people dying because they're taking fentanyl rather than heroin, because it's not regulated at all. But alcohol, it's regulated. So we know that people drinking alcohol are drinking alcohol. So it's a hugely complicated issue, and I don't think I know enough about it to say what is right or wrong in the whole regulatory debate. Yeah. But I do know that it's dangerous and it's scary to have to get drugs illegally, and it also causes them to not be able, you don't know what's in them because you know, they're not regulated at all.
Yeah, it is tricky, and I've read some research about how you're kind of supporting this idea that if drugs were regulated, if they were, you know, technically legal, you know, there would maybe be, you know, if someone does get in trouble, a safer route to healing, a safer route to the hospital, maybe less stigma coming from the moral side of things. But obviously, that's a slippery slope. That's very complicated. I don't know. You know, obviously, I don't have the answers, but it's interesting.
Right. And if anyone wants to look into a country that has done that, is Portugal has really legalized drug use and medicalized the issue of addiction. So if people are struggling with addiction, they get medical help rather than get arrested. And they seem to have good results with that.
Okay. Interesting. You've written about the opiate addiction and quote unquote epidemic before for Work at Health and elsewhere. What can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I became addicted to opioids. It was a relapse for me, not sort of a relapse. It was a relapse. And I, like so many people, this is a story I hear all the time. I have chronic pain. I have like a bad shoulder. I have some pain issues. And I was just trying to, you know, take a pill here or there to manage my chronic pain, unprescribed. So obviously that's not a good idea. But, and I became addicted so fast. It was so easy to become addicted to opiates. I remember there was just one weekend where I didn't take them and I thought I had the stomach flu. And my friend that I was getting them from, I said, "Oh, I think I have the stomach flu." And she said, "You probably are dope sick because you've been taking opiates and you're not now." And it was really shocking to me to realize that I got addicted so fast. I wasn't looking to, you know, I wasn't expecting to get so physically addicted to opiates so fast. And this is something I talk to people about very often, is that the sheer addictiveness of these opioids, they're the pills like oxycodone or Percocet, and then, you know, the substances like fentanyl or heroin, they really are bringing people to addiction faster, and they're really taking people out, you know, killing people in record numbers. And it's just the sheer strength of their addiction is really shocking.
And it's easily accessible?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that they are very easily accessible to get opioids or to get heroin. It's been a increase, you know, there were a lot more doctors prescribing pain medicines in the 90s. There was really this push to decrease people's pain. And kind of as that happened, there was also this push to, you know, there was easier access to cheap, high quality heroin, I guess you could say, in more of America. And so those two factors have kind of combined to expose more people to opioids more easily. So whereas maybe kids in the 80s were trying out Coke or whatever the drug of the moment was, I think kids today are trying out, you know, pharmaceuticals, which is incredibly dangerous because they are so addictive.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as an adolescent, 13, 14, I drank alcohol, never did drugs, but I can't imagine even having access to something like that. But obviously, you know, I'm much older than kids today. It's just interesting how times have changed in that way.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
What can you talk about? Well, one of the things I really enjoyed, you wrote a piece recently talking about the isolation of, I think it was the isolation of addiction or the isolation of the mental health that goes into like an addicted person. Like, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's one of the things I found most interesting about there's so much news about the opioid crisis, right? And we're always talking about like the opioid crisis. Oh my gosh, so many people are addicted to opioids. And the way that made me feel as a former person who was addicted to opioids is I just wanted to remind everyone that even though we're talking about this crisis, that there are hundreds of thousands of people that are struggling with this. When you are struggling with opioid addiction, it's an incredibly isolating thing. So it's not like we have this large community out there that is all struggling together, you know, though journalism is sharing about like this wave almost, you know, this epidemic that everyone is talking about. If you are actually struggling with addiction, you're not really talking about it with anyone. For me, it was very isolating because, first of all, it was surprising. I didn't really expect to get addicted, and I didn't really understand that I was getting so physically addicted to opioids, even as it was happening. And then second of all, as with all addictions, I was really ashamed. So it's really hard because I think we have this stereotype of someone who is shooting heroin and we imagine that person to be someone very far from ourselves,
right?
You know, and I've never shot heroin, but I was snorting, you know, instant release pain pills, and I was snorting them as soon as I woke up because I was going into withdrawal. And that's just not something I imagined myself doing. And I never imagined myself as the type of person who would do that. But that's opioid addiction. And that shame really keeps you hidden in addiction. And also just the there was a lot of bafflement that I couldn't stop because I wanted to stop so much. Opioids, especially prescription pills on the street, are very expensive. It's why so many people switch to heroin. And you get, like, I got very sick very quickly without them because the withdrawal is so extreme. So you're very much chained to opioids. And I felt very chained to them. So I wanted to stop, but they're so physically addictive that I couldn't stop. I would try and try, and I'd get so sick that I'd end up using. And that alone kept me from talking about it because it was so frustrating and embarrassing to me that I had this problem that I couldn't just stop myself. Because I imagine people saying, well, just stop, you know, and it's like, well, I can't because it feels like the worst thing ever when I stop using them and I just take another one. So it's really, there's a lot going on internally that it all combines to make it this very, very embarrassing and isolating experience. And that's something I think we don't talk a lot when we're talking about opioid addiction or the opioid epidemic or the opioid crisis, is that each individual person, it's a battle, you know. No one wants to become addicted to opioids. No one wakes up and is like, I'm just going to do heroin until I feel sick and then nod out and wake up and get sick again. It's not an exciting addiction, you know. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's something to think about.
I think that's really beautifully said, and you paint a picture. You know, we as a culture want to just say like, oh, they're doing it to themselves. You know, it's their fault. They're doing it to themselves. And that comes from stigma. That comes from ignorance. That comes from fear. But you're painting a picture of isolation, of struggle, of I'm at a point where if I stop, I'm in such physical pain, I have to keep going. And I don't know how to not. You know, and that's such an important perspective for someone like myself and for the listeners to know that people who are going through addiction are struggling, are isolated, and we need to create communities and people in our lives that will empathize with these people, sympathize and show them compassion, because they're having a hard, really, really hard time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What sort of stems into my question about like the impact of addiction on mental health. And I think that when we look at addiction, we just think of like you said, we think of people who are not us. We think of criminals. We think of, we'll never get there. We think of, you know, it's all their fault. They're making stupid decisions or what have you. And we don't think about the mental health aspect of it. And I think if we can, as a culture, maybe broaden things a little bit and think about it, maybe our into understanding addiction is through the mental health aspect of it and the impact on mental health that addiction has.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, how we recover from addiction is often now the recommended treatment for opioid addiction is medication and counseling. You know, it's very much a mental health issue, and it's very much an issue that, like other mental health issues like depression or anxiety, it's invisible. You know, we can see people that are performing very well in their jobs and, taking care of their families, but then also struggling very silently with this issue. And I also think that it is, it's an issue that is largely internal and often does occur with other mental health issues like depression or anxiety.
Right, right. All the more reason to check in with your friends, check in with the people in your life. Because so many things are silent. So many things are internal.
Right.
And the better we get at like sort of making connections on that internal level, on that sort of silent level, you know, whether that's through education or empathy, you know, finding the language, finding the tools, shedding our fears and stigmas around these things, the easier it will be to make those connections and allow each of us, you know, to maybe find a little hope, grow a little, get treatment, et cetera.
Exactly. And I think it's important to remember that all of those things are okay. You know, like if a friend is struggling with addiction or if they're struggling with depression or anxiety, it's not the end of the world. You know, it's a scary thing, but that can be okay. You know, they can be struggling with addiction and they can recover and they can have a good life. And it's just one aspect of their life. And it doesn't have to be an awful, awful, dark thing. And it doesn't have to make them a bad person.
Not at all. It's deeply human. And it's also, we have millions of examples of people who have experienced trauma in addiction, in mental health, you know, me with my depression and my anorexia. Like, we've seen countless examples of people who can be in recovery and can thrive and move past it. And so, like, we have all these, as I used earlier, as you are, Callie, beacons of hope to, like, allow us to feel a little less alone and maybe a little hopeful.
Right, right.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the work you're doing at Work at Health. I know you're one of the head, you're head of marketing there.
Yes, absolutely. I'm head of the marketing there. And we're doing a lot of exciting work, especially in the area of medication for opioid addiction, which is another really stigmatized area of addiction treatment. There's sort of a internal battle in the recovery world where people who have recovered from abstinence treatment don't really believe that medication use for recovery is valid. So even within this already stigmatized field, which is addiction, right? There's so much societal stigma from addiction. People are further stigmatizing what we call buprenorphine or Suboxone, these recovery meds that people can take for opioid addiction. Like I was explaining, it's so hard to quit opioids, especially without any help at all. And so what medications like Suboxone can do is they can help you avoid the withdrawal and kind of balance out your brain chemistry while you get your life back on track. So it's very important to talk about these medications and talk about how they work. They are effective, and it's okay to be on them. It's okay to be on any sort of medication, whether it's an antidepressant or whatever medication your doctor prescribes in recovery. That's something that we can do and have as part of our recovery from addiction. Work at Health is launching telehealth Suboxone programs. We have them in Michigan and California. The number of doctors who prescribe Suboxone is really limited because there are requirements. You have to have a special waiver to prescribe it. So we've had people drive 8 hours to have a first in-person appointment with our clinic. And after that, they have video conferencing with their doctors, they have online counseling, and they do online addiction courses that help them learn things like mindfulness, learn how to deal with relationships and recovery. So the really powerful impact of the program is that it's all online after that first visit. So it reaches a lot of people that couldn't get help otherwise, people who can't afford inpatient rehab, people with small children, people who can't take time off of work, a lot of people who are falling through cracks of our current systems of care are now able to find treatment with us.
That's amazing. I really commend the work you guys are doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an amazing journey to be on with Robin and Lisa, our founders, who are both in recovery themselves. I know Robin was a guest on the show. So, and yeah, it's been really neat to see people get their lives back. It's just a gift every day.
I love that. This is a strange question, but like, is it ever a hurdle for people who maybe were addicted to drugs, then take a drug to help them be a little better? Is that a hurdle ever?
Absolutely. That's a huge hurdle. And I think it's a fear because for me, example, like right now I'm on medications, you know, I take like antidepressants and other medications just to keep me healthy.
Yeah.
But I think the fear is that I took pain pills and I got addicted. I got screwed over by pain pills, you know?
Yeah.
So there is a natural mistrust of medications. And that really is a very strong mistrust, and strong is an understatement. There is a very, very strong hate of medications in some parts of the recovery community. And in some ways that really hurts people because you'll have people told by members of the recovery community to get off antidepressants. You'll have them told by members of the recovery community to get off anti-craving medication because there is this distrust of medication. Mm. And it's really a complicated issue. And it does take listening to yourself and listening to what you need for your own self-care and trusting the medical community to kind of know what the evidence is and know what the best thing for your own medical needs are.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We each of us have to ultimately, and it's hard and it's difficult and maybe a little scary, but we each have to like take our own bodies and our own minds as our responsibility. You know, we are the best arbiters of our own sort of mental health and care, and we're all different.
Correct. Yep. And being your own healthcare advocate is so powerful. You know, it's a scary step to make, but it's also can be so powerful to like learn that you can, you know, seek help for your own conditions and, you know, reach out to the medical community for help.
Yeah. How is your recovery going, Callie?
Thank you for asking. My recovery is going really well today. You know, I'm really involved in the 12-step community. I have commitments. I sponsor women in a 12-step community, and I meditate, which I think really helps me calm my mind. And in the past few years, I had a really rough around 5 years in recovery, I would say. But in the past few years, I've learned how much exercise can help me. So I'm not hugely fit, I would say, but like a very slow jog can really boost my mood and reduce my stress. And so today, that's a really important part of my recovery.
And how was it getting into meditation for you? Did it come easily? Was it difficult?
It did not come easily, and it still does not come easily.
same for me. I was just like, I want to do it more, but it has not come easy.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I will be like, should I scroll through Twitter for 5 minutes or meditate for 5 minutes? And my brain is like, scroll through Twitter, you know? There's some sort of internal struggle every time I think about meditating. But whenever I do it regularly, I notice the effects in a really big way. So I try to make it a regular part of my routine, and I don't always succeed. Sometimes I'll let it lapse, but I try not to beat myself up about it and just get back to it. I actually go to meditation meetings in my area, and so those will force me to go and sit in a room and at least meditate for 15 minutes with other people, you know, because you can't put it off if you're sitting there in a meditation group.
Sure. Yeah, you have that accountability.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and how many years are you?
Yep, I have 9 years now. And I think it's important to say that this time around was not my first venture into recovery. So I have 9 years and I'm 35 years old. But the first time I went to treatment was when I was 21. So I had several years of, you know, really struggling, just going to rehab, failing, you know, in and out of rehab, in and out of detox. So it was a journey for me. And I had to, you know, keep trying to get sober and never give up. And eventually I made it.
I'm so happy you did. It's a very difficult and courageous journey. And you've made it on the other side, and you continue to make it day by day, which is beautiful.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Of course. Let's transition into, we always kind of wrap up the show talking about empathy heroes. These are people in our lives who are just good examples of empathetic people. They could be even characters from movies or books. They could be historical figures, etc. I'll go first, give you some time to think about your empathy hero. My empathy hero this week is a gal who is a recent listener of the podcast. Her name is Lauren Michelle. She's at Lauren, L-O-R-E-N, MICHELLEM, Lauren Michelle M, on Instagram. She reached out to me recently and was just struggling. She's a new listener of the podcast. We had a quick Skype call just to chat because she was struggling, you know, not sort of finding people in her area to connect with, which I relate to in a major way. And I don't know, we just had a conversation, and she's clearly a very heart-first person and is maybe struggling a little bit how to navigate that stuff and finding grounding in that. But I was in awe and encouraged by her willingness to do that and her openness and vulnerability toward me. And it warms my heart that people like Lauren are listening to the show, interacting with it, getting something from it. Warms my heart. It's everything I want. And so Lauren, thanks for that. And we'll of course keep chatting whenever you want. And Lauren Michelle is my empathy hero this week.
That's so great that the show is kind of a beacon for people to connect with that are struggling to find community elsewhere.
Yeah, it's everything I wanted. I of course, like this show, I get a lot out of it for myself personally because I struggle with all of the isolation of feeling depressed and my anorexia and anxiety and, you know, suicidal stuff from time to time. But the goal, the intent is to give people a safe space. And we need that in our lives. So I'm just so grateful for people like Lauren who reach out and remind me of that.
That's great.
Yeah, thanks. How about you? Who's your empathy hero this week?
Always my heroes are Robin and Lisa, the founders of Work It Health. They're really shining examples, not only of recovery, but they are fearless leaders in, you know, this CEO space where there are very few women. There are very few women with mental health issues. So it's so cool to work with them and watch them in action, I guess, every day. But other than them, I think I would say some women that I've had a really neat chance to work closely with that I really admire just because they are writing about their own issues with addiction, with mental health, and they write so fearlessly and so honestly about it is Olivia Pennell and Elizabeth Brico. So they're two journalists, and writers that they blog for Work It Health, but they blog all over. And they both have really taken, a fearless and honest account of their own journeys in addiction recovery. And, they're not about, much like this show, they're not trying to put on the good face, I guess, or kind of sell themselves as, this neat package, but rather they're really kind of letting people in to connect with them in what recovery is like. And I think that's a really rare trait to have, a rare ability to have as a writer. And I think it's a really scary thing to do, to be vulnerable and talk about, you know, hey, this isn't going well for me. This is what happens at the good times. This is what happens at the bad times. This is just how it is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, kudos to them. And I'll make sure to link their writing in the show notes. That's so great to hear. Especially like writers, you know, I think it is hard to like put yourself out there knowing that, you know, people are going to read it, and just being honest with how you're feeling and allowing people to come into your heart a little bit is I think a deeply courageous act. So
right.
good on them.
Yes.
Well, Kelly, let's talk about where people can connect with you, learn more about or read your writing, learn more about Work It Health, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so people can read my writing on the Work It Health blog. So first, let me tell you where to find Work It Health. We are online at workithealth.com, just like it's spelled. And then the blog is workithealth.com/blog. And I'm an author there. And then you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Callie Reads Books, and I try and post anything I write there as well.
Awesome. Well, the listeners, all those links are in the show notes for this episode. Callie, thank you so much for being on Yumi Empathy, sharing your story. I think it's one that people will relate to. People will feel a little less alone. And I'm just grateful that the work you're doing at Work It Health is creating a safe, judgment-free space for people who are struggling with addiction.
Well, thank you so much for all the work you do, and thank you so much for having me on, and it's really been great.
Yeah, of course. And to you listeners, I'm here, you're here, we're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring pale blue dot. We have each other. It's Yumi Empathy.